I think the more stories that we share, and I think, you know, reflecting on the, you know, the exact time we're in right now, where the whole world is run by horrific men making disgusting choices about women, I think the more we can share our stories, the more we can be brave and, you know, share both the triumphs, but also, you know, I guess the vulnerable and hard moments, I think.
Welcome back to Not Too Busy to Write. I'm Penny Winsor, author and book coach. Today, I'm in conversation with comedian and Sunday Times bestseller Helen Thorne. One half of the comedy duo Scummy Mummies, Helen has been writing and performing stand-up comedy for more than a decade. 6 years ago, life as she knew it totally fell apart when she discovered her husband of two decades had been having a years-long affair. Very soon after, Helen wrote what would become her book, Get Divorced, Be Happy. It's a raw, beautiful, very funny and chaotic story about losing a partner, but finding love amongst the women who hold us together when life falls apart. 4 years on, with life a little bit calmer, Helen wanted to reflect on her experiences alongside other women who, for a variety of reasons, have had some curveballs thrown at them in midlife. The result is her new book, How to Face Change and Come Back Stronger. It's a compassionate look at how we grow through some of life's extreme difficulties. We chat about how pleasure is demonized for women in midlife, being honest on the page about the darkness that comes with experiences of loss, and the second mini griefs that can happen when not all of our friends come along for the journey. How to Face Change and Come Back Stronger is out April 2nd. It's funny, it's sad, it's incredibly hopeful and very compassionate. It's like receiving a massive hug from Helen herself. All of the links are in the show notes. If you are a writer working on a long project, such as a novel, memoir, nonfiction, or a Substack, and you don't want to do it alone, my membership for writers, The Fold, now has a brand new membership site. On this new membership site, there is weekly accountability and a space to chat with other writers who are going through really similar things. As well as that, we have all of the things we had before, including a weekly audio straight into your podcast feed, twice weekly co-writing sessions, and workshops every month led by guest experts. Latest ones have included Substack bestseller Claire Venus and Gold Nero Prize winner Claire Lynch. Membership is £20 a month and you can cancel it at any time. It is a really lovely community of writers and I would love to see you there. The link is in the show notes. Enjoy the episode.
Helen, thank you so much for being with me today.
Oh, it's a joy. It's so funny because we live so close to each other. I love that we're Zooming each other.
And we live down the road from each other.
Yeah.
I just thought, I'm just going to stick with the system I usually use, even though we could be in the same room. And actually, it would be fun to be in the same room, but it's fine. This is the next best thing.
Yeah, this is, you know, as a person who's always got 18 million things on, like yourself, it's like, yeah, this is great. I can do this in between everything else, between the washing piles and all that sort of stuff. So this is very good. This is ideal. This is exactly as it should be.
Well, I want to go back. First of all, 6 years ago, you discovered very suddenly that your ex-husband had been having a years-long affair. It totally turned your world completely upside down. You wrote a book about that time and its aftermath very soon after it happened. It was raw. It was intense. It was a Sunday Times bestseller. I want to first of all ask you about the response to that. Before we get into your new gorgeous book, I want to ask about the response that you had from women about writing something so soon after when everything was still so raw when you wrote that last book. And it's probably a very different writing experience to the one that you've just had writing this new book. But so first of all, I want to talk about the response you had from women who have been through a similar experience when you published that first book, that last book.
I guess this has been the absolute joy of writing that book. As you said, it was written in like this sort of incredibly painful, chaotic, confronting time. And the book is very raw and very brutal and honest. And I don't think I would write it like I do now. Like where I'm like, oh, just, you know, found my peace and happiness. But before I was like, fucked off. This is awful. What the hell? What? You know, everything was put into question. So I guess I channeled all that energy into it. And I guess the responses I've had, and I still get people writing to me every week from the divorce book, is that it's like, thank you for seeing me. Thank you for making me feel not alone. Thank you for understanding the crazy. Like people write to me going, oh, I've just bought a packet of cigarettes for the first time in 6 years. You know, just found out my husband's been sleeping with my best friend. It's so destabilizing. And I think having someone who just goes, who just holds your hand, who goes, you're going to be all right. But this is awful. Like I see you. I think having that connection and having that understanding of it, because you suddenly feel really isolated. You're not on the same path as everyone else. And I think that's what I felt like. You know, I was always wanted to be a mother, always wanted to be a wife, all those sort of things. And suddenly life got tipped upside down. And I guess I scrambled around for my identity. I scrambled around to where I belonged. So I think that is probably the strength of the book, because of just laying all that bare. Mm-hmm. And because I wrote it in COVID as well, I wasn't distracted by anything else but my pain. Mm-hmm. And I think that in a way, I kind of call it like sad boot camp, because yeah, I didn't have, like, you know, I wasn't working or I wasn't going out with friends. You know, of course I was drinking and smoking at home, you know, behind the shed and things like that. But I really had to raw dog every single emotion. And I think, yeah, I think that while it was confronting, there is a strength in that. And I don't know whether it sped up my recovery or sped up working through those sort of things, because obviously we never get over them. But there was an intensity that I think was beneficial in a way that I had to kind of, before I'm very good at smoothing things over, saying everything's okay, everything's fine. But the response has been phenomenal. And I think that's what I didn't anticipate people writing to me, just telling them how important the book was. I have women stopping me in the street and hugging me, which is just phenomenal. Like, you know, your book helped me or saved me. Or I had a woman came up to me last month who said, I listened to your audiobook driving in the car to make the decision to leave my husband. And I got goosebumps. Like, yeah. I was like I was sort of with her, like, because she was listening to it. And so yeah, I'm really proud of that book. Like, there's bits of that time I'm not very proud of. self-compassion.
I think let's get to that in a minute. But because I just think, actually, I think you dealt with it brilliantly personally. I really, really do. But I just wanted to point out something you mentioned in the introduction, I think, in this new book, that one of the comments you've had from women is that from married women who keep the book by their bedside to remind their husbands not to be a dickhead. And I'm like, those legends, like, honestly, that is legendary behavior. You might actually be the source of many people, many husbands getting their shit together and not getting divorced, in fact.
Yes, yeah, I think so. I think it did. I think it, a lot of friends said it was very helpful, and it presented or brought up questions for each other to ask. I know Ellie said when she read it, she went to Pete. Ellie is my scummy mommy partner. And she said to her husband, Pete, like, if there is anything you need to tell me, just fucking tell me this now. Not, you know, like,
yeah.
And they were both, sometimes when big hard things happen to people close to you, you kind of go, shit, what would I do in that situation? How am I going to face it? So yeah, I do love that. I love that the married people had read it. And, but also a lot of, I think the audiobook did a lot better than the hardback and the soft cover, because, people didn't want their husbands to see them reading it.
And I have to say, I do love the privacy of my audiobook library. It's a very private thing. I don't let anyone look at it.
No, I absolutely not. And often I download books in the middle of the night, or, you know, off the back of a podcast. And sometimes I don't even listen to them. Like, I must do that. And then I just never do. And then you, like, look through the history of your where did your thoughts go?
It's like my brain in the middle of the night. That's my audio book library. Yeah.
Yes. And then I'm like, I haven't read enough classical literature. I will download Moby Dick. And then like, I never read it. I won't listen to that. You know, when you're having like those guilt things, you're like, I haven't read enough Dickens. Fuck.
You are obviously a comedian. And I remember at the time when this happened, and we talked, I think, fairly early on when you decided to write that book. And I was thinking at the time, and then it refreshed again last year when Lily Allen obviously brought out that sort of epic album about her shit ex-husband, that I was like, what is wrong with men who marry these women who they know have voices, who know they use their art and their voice to talk about their lives? How are these men so stupid that they fuck over women like you and Lily Allen?
I know. It's like, I remember when my ex found out I was writing the book, and he's like, oh, I knew you'd do that. I was like, the fuck did you expect? Don't fuck over comedians. Don't fuck over, women with a platform, women with a voice. There are options. You don't have to put your dick in other women. That's your choice.
That is an option. It's an option. Yeah. And it's one that a lot of people manage to follow that option. Because I just had, like, with what happened last year with Lily Allen and her ex, like, had he ever listened to her music before is what I wanted to know. Because she's a storyteller and she goes hard and goes raw. Mm. And, he deserved anything that came at him, quite frankly. Also, we got an amazing album, so...
Yeah,
it's like we get amazing work from you out of this experience.
What a gift. I know it is about that sort of turning this darkness into something hopeful. And I think that's what I've always been determined to do in all these sort of aspects, because I think, even being at the receiving end of being bullied as a child and meant to feel other, when you felt othered and you felt like that, you're like, I don't want anyone else to feel that, come sit at my table. And I think that's what really drives me. And so, and I so appreciate when other women, and the women who are allowed and unashamedly themselves, they're my heroes. So I was like, not that I'll ever be anything like that, but I'd like to, be at their party. I want to be in that team.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, one of the things you write about in your latest book is this idea of wanting to kind of turn the shame around from divorce. There is still so much shame around it. And by talking about it, by being open about it, being honest about it, it's like just exposing lots of light to it. It's like, why should we feel ashamed for getting divorced? Like, why should we?
Yeah, exactly. And I think there's so much heavy language around, failure or what. I always got asked, what would you have done differently? How could you have? I was like, nothing. I mean, I don't think it's helpful. Like, I think, through therapy, I did reflect on how awful my marriage was in retrospect. And I think, I have learned so much about myself and about relationships and how I respond to things and things like that. So I think that's really important. But I think, in terms of taking away the shame of divorce, so many women now who have gone through it, and we're talking about it more and more, which was brilliant, have just really celebrated themselves, celebrated their freedom, celebrated, I guess, the strength that it takes to make the decision to rebuild your life as well. So there's so much to be, to rejoice about, rather than kind of going, oh God, they didn't make it work or whose fault it was. I mean, even the fact the law now has changed to a no-fault divorce, I think that is helping in a way. Although I was very keen to have it noted in law that he was an adulterer.
I know. I feel like a lot of people are feel that that's quite important. It's like, no, I did my bit. Someone else did not.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So I think the more stories that we share, and I think, reflecting on the exact time we're in right now, where the whole world is run by horrific men making disgusting choices about women, I think the more we can share our stories, the more we can be brave and, you know, share both the triumphs, but also, you know, I guess the vulnerable and hard moments. I think it's, now it's more important than ever, because I feel like we feel defeated at the moment. It can be too much. So I think, that was a very long answer to your question.
It's so true though, isn't it? It's so true. Like, we are literally surrounded in the media by people who are doing abhorrent things. And if we can't talk about them, you know, openly within just, you know, a relationship, we're not going to be able to talk about them on a much wider scale. You talk about losses of all kinds in this book. You interview lots of women about different kinds of losses they experience and how they rebuild their lives afterwards. Since your divorce 6 years ago, you have also very recently lost your mum. The 2-year anniversary has just passed. And it's really interesting, actually, because I felt like after my mum died, I was very young when my mum died, I was 22. I felt like one thing that I didn't understand about grief was that the next time a big grief happens, the grief from the previous grief comes back again as well.
Yes.
You know, like, so when your mum was dying, when you knew she was dying, and when she did die, did that for you bring up a lot of the grief of the end of your marriage, particularly because of how your marriage ended in a big betrayal? Was that a surprise to you that your mum dying brought up this sort of grief that you thought perhaps had maybe started to settle a little bit?
Yeah, I think so. And I think it's that uncertainty and that sense of worth and who loves you and how you are loved, and I guess all those hopes and dreams that you had for yourself. You know, ever since I was a little girl, I always wanted to be married, and ever since I was I've always had a really close relationship. I think the word untethered is probably the right word, like feeling really lost again. And that was the familiarity. That was the sort of string that came through. It's like, now what? How do I move when I'm not a daughter? How do I get, like, I used to call my mum in the morning after the kids went to school, and I'd be like tidying up, and I'd ring mum like at 8:30, and then I'd get on with my day at 9. And that was that sort of juncture between dropping the kids off and then, like, get, you know, and just like, oh, I've done this, that, and the other. And it's like, when your life is not witnessed by someone you love, it loses something. You know, you want someone, like, you just want to say, mum, look what I did. Or, you know, if I was married, like, oh, look, you know, look at our life. Look at all these things. And I think that's where I felt the loss. And that's where that bubbled up again, going, oh, you know, I've just lost another person that was part of who I was and part of who I considered every day. And I think it's that psychophysiology. It's very interesting, you know, in researching this book about how our brains are altered when we are in long-term relationships, whether that's, you know, family or spouses or whatever, that you're sort of intertwined, and like you consider them every time you make a choice. And then for those to be sort of yanked out, you've got this sort of chasm, and you sort of, that's where you can feel really discombobulated for a long time. And, you know, even though, you know, I instantly knew my marriage was over, like when I found out about the affair, it took my brain a very, very, very long time to think as a single, I don't know what it was like for you, think as a single person and try and make sense of it. So I think that's still very much in my nervous system. And I still dream of my mum very vividly, but dream of her well. She was really sick at the end, and having chats with her. So it's sort of, yeah, grief is, you know, it's endless. It's a long, it's, you know, this is now going to be with me forever. But yeah, it was some of the questions I was trying to pose in the book about, like, well, I've been through this one big thing, so like I'm very strong now. And then something else, I'm like, oh no, I can break again, and that's okay.
Yeah.
But also, I've got some more tools in which to navigate and get, you know, it's like hiking up the mountain again, but you got a bit more in your rucksack.
Yeah. See, that was
even though the mountain is still big to climb. You know what I mean?
That was what was so interesting about reading about it, because I did feel reading it, and I wanted to ask you about that, whether you felt you know, having gone through this kind of pretty cataclysmic kind of life change that sort of happened, you know, it happened overnight, whether that meant that you had more tools to deal with the next big grief, which was your mum dying. And that's what's so hopeful about this book in many ways, because it really does show that we can learn to live with the big griefs and the big changes, even if we wouldn't have chosen them, you know, even if we'd never have chosen them. And we can face the next one that's inevitable because we're human. So if we love people, we're going to lose them. That's just an annoying, stupid fact of being human, sadly.
Yes, a great cost of love, yeah.
But like the idea that we can kind of somehow we can continue to function, that we know we can continue to function. I remember having chats with friends who also lost parents in their 20s. And sometimes we would just look at each other and just be like, God, don't you feel sorry for everyone who hasn't been through this yet? Because they don't know what's coming. They don't know what's coming. And we know, and we've consolidated some of that now. And it's like looking at someone and just going, oh, you don't know what it's going to be like. And I feel so bad for you. It's still coming. I know that sounds terrible, but it is like, it is amazing how we can kind of learn to live with these big griefs.
Yeah. And you are changed. You are fundamentally changed by them. And it's sort of weird when you know, you still have to go to work and you still have to occupy the same kind of, movie, you know, but you're essentially a slightly different character. You react to things slightly differently. You've got a new lens on things. And, And I feel, a real mix of sort of quietening, of slowing down, of before when I reacted to, my divorce loss, and that was a sort of a rush to plaster things over. That was through alcohol, cigarettes, sex, spending, all these sort of dopamine hits and these ways in which I can numb the pain. But now I'm very much like, right, when I've encountered a really sad thing, the last thing I want to do is drink alcohol. The last thing I want to do is smoke. I want to be outside. I want to walk in the rain. I want to feel things more deeply rather than avoiding them. And I think that has been the fundamental shift, and that sadness sits with me more comfortably. And I can say to people, I'm a bit sad today, which before I would find really, and now I go, I'm a bit sad today, and I'm probably going to be a bit sad tomorrow, but I can still find the joy in every day, and also the tiniest bits of joy. Like that's concentrated. Like the flowers are brighter, the music is more soothing. Like all those sort of things have been fundamentally changed. So I think, it's hard to explain. You sort of like there's pain and sadness in there, but then the joy has been amplified, and the relationships are stronger, and the happiness is intensified in many ways. So it's sort of
It's so true, isn't it? It's like everything is ramped up a notch, and that can be deeply uncomfortable in many ways. But there is joy that also is amplified at the same time. Now let's talk about you were saying that your initial reaction to divorce was quite an intense getting things out of your system, smoking, dating, casual sex, back on the fags again. But you know what's really interesting, and I love that in this book you really talk about that, Helen, with so much compassion, because I feel like I felt it at the time when I knew you were going through it, but also I feel it again reading this, is that you would doing what you needed to do. You were just doing what you needed to do. And I feel like sometimes we're so quick to try and get people better, you know, like better in inverted commas, like happy again. And even in fact, I have a bit of an aversion to the word healed, because I sort of feel like it's almost like it makes it seem like there's an end goal and you'll get there and live there from now on kind of thing. And I just think we have to have so much compassion for ourselves. We're in the acuteness of grief for whatever, you know, the loss is. But reacting the only way we often can at the time.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think I did feel that it sat with some of my behaviors, sat uncomfortably with people who love me. And that was only because they cared for me, because they could see that the behaviors were destructive and I have compassion for them. But I also have to have self-compassion because I was so lost. And I thought, but I'm showing that I'm rebellious. I'm having a drink. I'm going out on dates, or, you know, smoking felt like a connection with my younger self. And I was trying to reestablish, like I did, because I'd started dating my ex-husband when I was 19. I didn't have a 20s. And I was like, well, the last time I was single, I was 19. Who was I? And so I sort of went back to that girl. I went back to that person because I was rebuilding from that point, because I was like, but I'm a single person now. How does a single person, you know, live? And I guess that was my only reference. And I think because I lived a kind of very goody two shoes life for so long, I wanted to see what it was like. I was sort of slightly jealous of friends who'd had a rebellious 20s. And I thought, well, it's my turn now. I want to do a bit of that, you know. And then when people were like, no, Helen, you need to be single and you shouldn't do this and you shouldn't do that. And I was like, but why don't I get a turn? You know, is it because I'm in my 40s and a mum? Is there, you know, and it wasn't like I was doing all that stuff around my children. It would be like the weekend that the kids were with their dad. And so there was a bit of disjuncture there. And there's times where I've thought, God, I did drink and smoke too much. But also I was just experimenting and playing and I also want to write all that out, because I think if I was just going, well, in 6 years' time and now I've run some marathons and this is how I live now, I think it wouldn't be fair to the women going through what they're going through now. And I want to lay it all bare out for people and be brave enough to share that darkness, because I think that was the strength of the last book, but also that's the strength of what women are good at, is that not pretending that everything's okay all the time, because then that's when you will have the connections with other women. And, you know, and I wanted to include things like spending addiction and all those things that are so heavily marketed to us as vulnerable women, like alcohol's heavily marketed to us and all those sort of things. And now, of course, there's weight loss jabs and all that sort of stuff that, you know, all those sort of things are saying, if you just buy this thing, you will be better. As you were saying, you will be healed. You will be, you know, it equals fun or equals a certain status. So I think when you're feeling vulnerable, that's when all that can affect you. And it's okay. It's all right. But it's, I wanted to show what it was like in it, but also the pathways through and out of it, and also all that self-compassion and forgiveness and acceptance of that as well.
I was 37 when my ex and I split up, and I knew a man who was going through a divorce at the same time, and he didn't have children. I remember sort of mentioning about, having gone out on a, you know, for a drink here and there, you know, like when I had care for my kids, and also when they were with their dad, like not often, because like once or twice a week max, right? And I remember him being a bit like, you know, just be really careful. You don't go down a really kind of blah, blah, blah road. I'm like, dude, I am a mum. I have been, I've been married for 10 years. I've been towing the line. I've done all of the right things. Just give me this. I'm doing it in a very compartmentalized, totally away from my children. What I was doing wasn't even unsafe. You know, not really. It was just like drinking more and going out on dates. Like it wasn't that big a deal. But it was just so funny how very quickly people are like, ooh, be careful. Ooh, be careful. You know, like, you know, should you be doing that at your age with your responsibilities? And it's like, dude, I like, if I'm going to cope with my responsibilities, I need to have the odd blowout.
Yes. Yeah. And I think pleasure is demonized for women our age. Yes. Like, you know, it has to, you know, and we have to deprioritize it. You know, everything is way ahead of that on the list. And like, you know, enjoying your body, enjoying having a few wines with friends or having a date or whatever. We are really punished for that. And it's a real shame. And I wanted to interview, I interviewed Dr. Karen Gurney, who's a sex therapist, psychosexologist, and she's so great at talking about how women feel such shame around pleasure, and also that we're basically taught that if the man has a good time, then that's a good time. Like if we're only talking within a heterosexual framework, and that so many women, do get an increase in libido after a big change in their life, like after losses and things like that. And also sometimes people get an increase of libido after grief. Mm. And I asked Carrie Ad-Lloyd about this, and she said, this is your body's way of telling you you're still alive.
Yeah.
That you're still made it. Like you know, sex is one of those life forces that, and so people go, oh, it's all really bad. I had this sort of sexual explosion after grief. And it's like, no, it's actually a pretty human response to something so dark. It's a bit like when you get the giggles in a funeral.
Yeah.
Like you've got to,
absolutely. Yeah. And it was funny, actually, I talked to Catherine Newman about this when I interviewed her on the podcast, because she wrote this gorgeous novel, We All Want Impossible Things, about somebody caring for their best friend in a hospice as they were dying. And the character in this novel was having sex with everybody. And it was her way of dealing with the fact her best friend was dying. And we were talking about that, how that to me felt incredibly real. I lived in New York around 9/11, and everyone was having sex with everybody afterwards. Like, I mean, it was insane how much sex everyone was having. And it was definitely a very kind of visceral reaction to being faced very, like, really confronted with death.
Oh, close.
And like death on a mass scale, but a really indiscriminate death, right? You know, totally random who died, you know.
Mm.
And it, to me, since then, I've really kind of, since that experience, really noticed actually how death and sex are so often closely linked.
Yes,
and
yes, you're right.
That feeling of like, oh my God, I'm alive.
Yeah, and I wanted to explore that. And I think, and neither way, like some people retreat from it and others, you know, really lean into it. And both are correct. Like you don't know, no one knows how they're going to respond to grief or big, hard things. So I think, again, I wanted to be really honest about that, because there'll be someone reading it going, shit, yes, I just wanted lots of sex after this big change or this big grief. You know, am I alone? It's like, no, you're not. And I'm sort of laying everything out quite bare and in a raw way in the book, but I want that so other women don't feel that shame. And it's sort of unpicking all of that. And also trying to ask the questions that a lot of us are probably a bit afraid to ask. And I think writing the book and, you know, over a good couple of years, I got braver and braver with the interviews I had. Mm-hmm. And also I felt much sort of deeper connection with the people I interviewed, because they, you know, felt comfortable sharing their stories with me. But also the more I learned about that, it influenced how I'm living my life now, about talking about hard things and also having a stronger voice within myself as well. So I think that's I hope that comes across in the book. But
really beautifully. Yeah. You write quite a bit about your body and your relationship to your body in the book. And I wanted to ask you a little bit about that. So something you wrote about, which I thought was really, really, really interesting, and I wanted to ask you about it. When you had a doctor after this period where you were kind of went a bit crazy, you had a doctor say to you, look, you've got to make some changes. You're not healthy. Your body's not coping with how you're living. Mm. And you wanted to make some changes. You felt ready to, but you were afraid what it was going to mean for you and for you being on stage if you lost weight, when so many women had looked to you for being a woman in a body that looked very like theirs and being proud and front and center on stage. And I wanted to ask you about that feeling of worrying about what it would mean to other women if you happened to lose weight.
Yeah, I was really conscious of that because I was really proud of being a size, you know, 18 to 20 woman who went out in a gold cat suit unashamedly and confidently and did jokes. And so many women, would come up after our Scummy Mummy show going, so nice to see a woman who looks like me and being represented and that, you know, and not othered.
And being happy.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I had a Instagram, like when I created my first sort of solo Instagram account, it's called Helen wears a size 18. And I was really keen to show what a woman's body looked like in high street clothes and that sort of thing. And I love that community and being part of that. When I first started having like dates and sex, I never apologized for my body and never felt less desirable either. And I was really keen to talk about that in the book as well, because I was like, yeah, you know, I was sexy and desirable. But yeah, the health change came after having these blood tests, and they were like, look, you've got no immune system, basically. You've got no vitamin D. You're on the way to diabetes and heart troubles. And I was like, right, Thorn, come on. You've got to do something about it. So yeah, so I was lucky enough that I've got a friend, Amber, who is a nutritionist, a nutrition coach, and she helped me kind of, I guess, have a new relationship with food, that it wasn't sort of just there for comfort and punishment. And it was a slow, slow process. So I lost weight over sort of about 18 months, and then I started doing a bit of running. But there was never ever a goal or a number that equaled happiness, or there was never ever a dress size that equaled success. So it sort of happened, and I now have been basically the same size for about 3 years. Like, I sort of found where I'm at, and I can move around and, you know, still have a good time and eat and drink as I like, but move as I like as well. So I think it was hard. And then, you know, I did get some negative comments from women going, you're not who you said you were, you've let us down. And that hurt. That really hurt. And it wasn't, you know, I wasn't doing it to hurt them. I was just on my own sort of path. So I think that was a big, big thing to kind of face and navigate. And it's like, no, I have to do this for my own health and my own sanity. And and joy. Like, I enjoy my body, but it's not that I didn't enjoy it beforehand. And it's not that.
This is what I love about the way you write about your body, because I think so often when people write about their bodies, they talk about hating the old one and loving and appreciating the new one. And not necessarily just for the way it looks, but because, you know, it can perhaps perform in a certain way, you know, because they've got more energy or whatever it is. But you never, ever talk badly about your body 5 years ago, ever. Like, there is not a single bit of it on the page. And it's so beautiful. You speak about your body with so much care, but you're also honest about the fact that part of the trauma, I guess, you know, in getting divorced and the way it happened, was a rejection of the body, and you had to build a new relationship with it after being rejected.
Yeah. And I think that was the hardest thing. And I do write about, after I, you know, found out at my husband's affair, and I said, why did you have this affair? And he said, well, I just didn't find you beautiful. I, you know, you're a great mom and you're great with friends, but, you know, essentially he wasn't attracted to me anymore. And I remember, dropping to the floor, going on all fours, and I sort of mooed like a cow. Like, it was kind of bovine. Like, it was so primal. I was so shocked by that. I wasn't, like, my body wasn't good enough and that I wasn't desirable. And I think part of that, you know, my explosion into the dating scene was that rebelliousness to feel like the most amount of desire that I possibly could. And I think that was that reaction there. But yeah, to be rejected in such a callous way. I mean, he'd lied about so much. Yeah, and so many other things. He'd been very honest about that. What a gift. So I think that was, so it's taken time to kind of, I guess, just find the peace in all of that. And be okay in the size that I am, because as we all know, we're not going to please everybody.
But also, we're never going to stay the same.
No.
We'll be changing for the rest of our lives. Like,
exactly. And now I'm in the full, you know, the full eye of the perimenopausal storm, and things are like, bits of me are inflated that I didn't know were inflating, and, you know, like, everything's changing. So yes, I think it's having a bit of peace around the change and kind of just accepting what you can do and having love and appreciation for what it can do.
Because it sort of ties in that aspect of some people being uncomfortable with the fact that you were not the same size that you used to be. Similarly, you found a few people were a bit uncomfortable with you being really happy, or you trying new things and that kind of stuff. And you spoke to some really interesting psychologists about the psychology behind that. You know, when we go through a big change, the friends that are deeply uncomfortable with the changes that you make are the ones that kind of can ride along with you, and then the ones that are kind of deeply uncomfortable with it.
Mm.
It was really interesting to read about the psychology behind that, because it's almost like, I suppose, when we make changes, it's almost like holding a mirror up to some people, right?
Yeah, yeah. And I found that really interesting. I think, well, in the first book, I talked a lot about how brilliant friendships or friends are getting you through this. I also wanted to be a little bit bolder in this book and talking about when friends aren't so cool with when you change, because this is kind of like a second mini grief after big change. And I wanted to really talk about that in a very considered but also compassionate way, because every woman that I had spoken to in the research for the book had said some friendships had ruptured after that. Whether it was Rosamund Dean speaks about this very beautifully. She'd gone through breast cancer and she was no longer drinking alcohol, and friends were pressuring her to, like, just have a drink, and she said, No, I can't, like, I don't want to anymore. And she said that, and she articulated this much more eloquently than I am. But some of those friends sort of petered out, because she realized that alcohol was the thing rather than the friendship was what was the glue there. And then other friends, said that it was confronting to their friends when they started dating or even just getting more confident. Mm-hmm. And I think, And some, like Rebecca Humphreys, talks about it really beautifully, that she presented as a reminder of another possibility in life.
Yeah.
And that can sting a bit, like, oh, that woman's happy and she's single. And it can bring up questions in couples that they may not be happy. So she said, but one of the beautiful things is that friends can come back.
Yeah.
It might be just for a time that's not. And also, and so that you make new connections and that you find, I think it's Laura Dockrell, who's an amazing author. She's like, you want to walk with people who've walked over the same hot coals as you, and without explanation, without apologies or anything else, just they know you. They know that path you've been on. And that's okay as well. That's not betraying your old friends or betraying, but to be seen is so important. And so, it can just dig the roots a little bit deeper in this new place that you're occupying. So it's good.
I love reading about how you felt about running. You wrote this really beautiful thing about when you finished your first marathon, how you felt like as you crossed that line, you were just Helen. Like you weren't a wife, you weren't a mother, you weren't one half of a comedy duo, you were just Helen. It was such an incredible way of describing it. What does it mean to you now? Like now you've been doing it for a while, are you 10 marathons in? How many are you in?
Yes, I'm just about to do my 12th, I think. So I did my first, that first one was October 2021. So it was like 18 months after my divorce. And it was really life-changing. And it was something that I had to, three times a week I had to choose myself, which in itself seems kind of radical as a mom. Like just choosing to have an hour by yourself feels pretty brave. And I think anyone who's had either small children or single parent or it's just difficult to leave the house like that. That in itself was a really big change. And I think those little steps every week, making those choices for myself, kept building and building and building and building. It was sort of like training for my own self-confidence.
Mm.
And I think having a date in a diary or having something to aim towards, again, was a new thing as well, because I was like, oh, I don't want to do anything big, don't worry, I'll be bad at it, But then doing that first marathon really, it just changed something in me that I could choose myself and the world wouldn't fall apart, you know, that I could do that. And also it actually was better when I chose myself for a bit.
Yeah.
I was a better mum. I was a better friend. I processed things. And also running came off the back of, you know, a couple of years of talking therapies. And I could just feel those, you know, that lovely, you know, the dopamine, the endorphins, the serotonin, all the good stuff, you know, the equivalent, I think Julia Samuel says, is, you know, half an antidepressant. And just getting myself outside, the circuit breaker. And running still does that today. And I really look forward to the runs. I'm like, if I'm feeling a bit bonkers, if everything's a bit overwhelming, I'm like, that is one guarantee in my life that I know if I go out the door for an hour, I will feel better. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it could take me about 3 or 4 hours. I faff about so badly. But, yeah, I think that's it. It's just become part of who I am. So, yeah, I really, the great thing about running is that whatever you give to it, it gives back to you.
Mm-hmm.
And I think when my life was so uncertain, that has been a certainty. So that's great. And it's been incredible. Like I've run marathons around the world. I love the community of women runners. It's, you know, like all these beautiful communities that I've, because of this one shitty thing in my divorce, I'm now part of the most richest communities of single parents, comedians, podcasters, and runners and people in fitness. So I think it's that's the real gift. And I love, it's a triumphant, you know, everyone cheers you on in the women's running community, and it's beautiful.
Oh, that's so great. And I you mentioned as well, and this resonated so much, and I'm sure so many people listening will have had this, when they were kids, their dad ran, but their mum didn't. And that's because it was easier for dad to get out of the house, and never easy for mum to get out of the house, because even if you had a partner that was like, oh, you know, go on then, kind of thing. Really, I think culturally, to give yourself time to do something like train for a marathon is not something that we usually give mothers permission to do, especially when their children are younger. And so to be able to give that to your kids, to be able to model it for your kids, is a pretty amazing thing. And that's how I always think of, I don't run marathons, but like that's how I always think of, you know, the time I spend writing and running my own business and doing all those other things. And also even just taking breaks from my kids and having them spend time with their dad, and they know it's because I need a break. And being able to model that for them is like an extra thing we're doing, positive thing that comes out of it.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's it. I think you don't do your children any favors by being a doormat.
Yeah.
You don't, you know, obviously I'm there for my children as much as I can be, but I'm a so much better mother. And also it's interesting, like both my kids now come for a run with me. Like my daughter did her first 5K the other day with me, but I've never told them to run. But then they've gone, oh, they've wanted to go, whether they run next to me or they're on their bike, you know, doing laps at the local park or the cemetery or whatever. So I think that, yeah, I think that role modeling, which I, you know, so much of what I do now, and especially after mum's died, is sort of trying to live the life that she didn't get. And I think that's part of, you know, how I keep her with me. I'm like, right, I'm doing this one for you, mum. I'm doing this one for all the women who were, you know, for whatever reason, had to stay at home. So, yeah, that keeps me going greatly.
One thing that comes up in a few different places in the book is this idea of you feeling like you didn't really want to accept help. You didn't really want to be sad in front of other people, but you also didn't really want to accept help because it felt like you were taking something from them. But you talk about how you learned that accepting help was actually giving that person something in return. And it's so interesting when that finally clicks, because that took a while, but when I got divorced, it finally clicked for me, because actually it feels really good to help a friend. It feels really, really good.
It does. And it's only like, I love being the giver. But it did really sit uncomfortably where people were like, oh, I'll make you a dinner. I was like, I don't have time. But actually to receive, you know, a lasagna or soup or something like that, it's just divine. And you can see the joy because, you know, when your friend is in pain, all you want to do is take that away. And if that, you know, if your love language is food, or if your love language is like, oh, look, let me just have the kids for a bit, or whatever you can do, I think that's such, you know, but it's something we're not taught, and it's something that's not immediately in our toolbox as well. But I wanted to talk about, and I loved it. I think it was the Reverend Kate Botley who talked about the mutuality of that. Mm. You know, like it's you're both getting love from it.
Yeah. Yeah. I definitely felt like my kids were 5 and 3 when I got divorced, and I definitely feel like I was a much better community member in my local community as a result of being a single parent than I would otherwise have been.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause you know.
Yeah. I just,
and you know, the impact of that
more in every way in terms of the receiving and the giving. I just, it's incredible actually. And I feel like I get so much out of what I put in terms of community, to the point where I was in like Cornwall recently for like a writer's retreat thing. And the guy who runs the farm shop there was, you know, I was like, oh yeah, I'm live in Southeast London. He's like, oh, you know, London doesn't have a community anymore. And I was like, are you fucking kidding me? I
have
the best community. Like, I mean, I couldn't have asked for a better community. I mean, it would have been nice to have more actual family around. But aside from that, I mean, I've had the most incredible experience of the community in London. Like, incredible.
Yeah. Yeah, I feel that too. I mean, I'm lucky I live on a little cul-de-sac. So there is a sort of ready-made little village here. But also, like, the community at school, you know, I love that I know the people down the road in the shops by their first name. They know us. They've been, you know, at the Greasy Spoon, they've been giving my son bacon sandwiches since he was about 1 year old and he's 14. And it's the same people. And I just, it's life-giving. It really is. It really is amazing. And I think, you know, and both the communities that are in real life and also online now that we have this, you know, connection with, I think that's really, really important as well. So depending on what your, you know, physical abilities are, if you can connect with others online as well, that's really important as well. But yeah, London is just a series of villages and it just feels like we're in a little town here.
I know, we're very, very lucky. The local shop that knows my son, who's quite disabled and can't really speak, but they know him really well, is the same shops that I know Ellie went to when she was a kid, which always just makes me so happy. The idea that one family that runs that shop is just, they just know everyone. They know everyone. They see everyone's kids grow up. Yeah, I love it.
Gorgeous. No, we're so lucky. We're so lucky with that around the corner. Yeah.
I feel like we can't not talk about falling in love in our 40s.
Yes.
What incredible, I feel like it's been an incredible privilege to go through that. It's very different to falling in love in your sort of teens and 20s, I think. You write in the book about how you were really fine with the fact that if your life was your friends and your cats and your kids and casual sex, if that was what it was going to be, But that hasn't been how it's ended up. You are in a relationship with a gorgeous guy. Mm. And I wanted to just ask you about, for you, that experience of falling in love at a very different stage of life. As you said, you met your ex when you were 19, a baby practically.
Mm. Yeah. So this lovely relationship I'm in now, it's very nice and he's a lovely, lovely man. But I wasn't sort of seeking that or expecting that. And also I'd gotten so used to just feeling happy in myself, within my home, within my, you know, our lovely family of three. But this unexpected love came along and it really kind of, it changed everything I knew about love, because we'd both gone through big, hard things. Like, he'd lost both his parents and he'd also gone through a brain tumor as well. So we both came to this relationship having faced some pretty awful stuff. And yeah, I think it has taken so much vulnerability and so much honesty and trust and kind of going, oh, I've still got all this shit that I'm dealing with and I'm sorry, but this is how I'm going to react to this. And just knowing that there's a safety net there, that the person's going, that's okay, we're going to work this out together.
Mm-hmm.
Not why you like this. It's like, we can work this out. It's going to be all right. And yeah, I adore this sort of very mature and trusting and playful love. You know, I felt more, I felt younger and I felt more in love. And I think that I did, and more genuine and more sort of rich love than I did when I was younger, because I've been around the block. I own my own house. I know who I am. I know who my friends are. You know, we're not going to have children together. I mean, that's kind of sad in a way, but also like he loves my children like they're his own children. And it's, yeah, and we're just sort of navigating life and also appreciating the preciousness of it. So, yeah, it's glorious. And also I think I don't want to sound bleak, but there's also a safety or comfort knowing if anything does happen, I'm going to be all right. I can live by myself. And
it's really, isn't that amazing? Actually,
it's such a weird thing to say.
Being like, through a big, big, big breakup that you thought was going to be it forever, and we survived, and not only survived, we've done pretty well. Like we're pretty good,
pretty awesome. Yeah, I think there's almost a comfort and there's a freedom in that as well. That, and I think you and I have talked about it. It's like, but every day we just choose each other.
Mm.
And something that's like, oh, well, you're here now. I can behave however I like. No, I'll behave my best because you're the best thing I've ever felt, I've ever been with. You know, like it's, we work hard at it. And it does require, you know, not being complacent and having those hard conversations when it arises. And always, always after going through or having those big sort of tricky conversations like, oh, I feel this, or when you said that or whatever, we always feel closer and we always feel like we move forward. So it's sort of, yeah, it's just having that trust there is really, I know it's really hard for people, especially if you've gone through toxic relationships or are scared to get your heart broken. But yeah, when you're a bit brave and take that leap of faith, it does reward you.
It's so true. And I think there is something, as you said, really amazing about the fact that you know you'd be fine. So if you had put yourself out there and it hadn't worked out, you would do so knowing that you've survived it before you'd survive it again. And I think there is such freedom in that. I feel like that's the thing that's meant I've been able to be vulnerable with somebody.
Yes.
Knowing that I know who I am in myself and I know I will survive if this doesn't work out means that I can kind of give it a whirl and go all in.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And it's delightful. And I, you know, this, it's not, it's not something I ever kind of expected. And we're still a bit giddy. Like it's been 3.5 years. We keep going, this is really great. This is lovely. We really like each other. And us do this big grown up thing. So I think that's great. And having someone to explore the world with and see the world in a new way. Like we've made a decision that every year we want to go to a different city that neither of us have been to before. So we have create new memories in the city. So that's really nice. I think just little things like creating your own rituals, creating your own traditions, like that's a lovely thing. But also it's sort of like you and I have both partnered with men who haven't had children. And, you know, I think that's the only tricky thing is like he's like, oh, why don't you try this? Or why is it like that? And that's hard. You just take a little deep breath and like, it's best I can do today.
Yeah, it is what it is.
Yeah, I know. I know I shouldn't be making 3 different separate meals tonight, but fuck it. That's
where it's life. He's having pizza. Where we are.
Yeah. We're just going to get through it. And no one died. It's all right.
Everyone is alive.
Yeah,
I know. One thing that I love that you wrote about this idea of self-trust, and self-trust is one of the things that can come out of experiencing a big loss of all different kinds. And you talk to so many women in the book about really different kinds of big losses, women who have experienced cancer diagnosis and really extensive treatment, divorce, obviously, postnatal psychosis, sick, all kinds of really life-changing, disruptive experiences. And this idea of building self-trust again afterwards, do you feel like you can now trust that if you pause and listen, you can feel what your body and your mind are asking from you?
Yes, I'm much better. I'm not always 100%. And I think there is always the overarching, how's this going to affect other people? Like that's never going to go away. And I think, and also, but that's just who I am. You know, I always want to be a bit compassionate. But yeah, I think it's having that foresight to go, how am I feeling now? But if I don't make these interventions, how is that going to manifest tomorrow, the next, you know, like calling things out, going, no, I need to not go to that event, or I need to, you know, I need to schedule in more time alone. I, you know, don't overcommit, all those sort of things. So it's sort of just trusting myself that I can say no and it's going to be okay. Or sometimes I'm just going to have to work hard and the kids can feed themselves and that sort of stuff. And they'll be all right. I'm not a bad mom. It's just the situation we're in. And having that base level trust of myself and base level trust of the love and the relationships that I have around me that are rock solid. So I think that's really good, because I think I didn't know it, but I was in a constant state of, you know, being gaslit by someone for 2 decades, like nearly 22 years. And that's disruptive when you're not quite sure and you're always second guessing every decision you make. Now go, all right, we're going to do that. And it may blow up, but a decision needs to be made and I need to kind of crack on with things. So I think, that's been such a empowering and strengthening thing to be able to make those decisions with conviction, because I think, when you've gone through the worst thing, you're like, well, the worst has happened, you know.
It's very true. It's very, very true. Oh, Helen, it is a glorious book. It's so glorious. It is so hopeful and it's filled with just incredible stories as well as your own. Thank you so much for writing it and sharing it with the world. This experience was quite different this time in terms of the writing, wasn't it? Because you took quite a lot longer, like you gave yourself more time to do this one.
Yes.
And in terms of what that then feels like to have finished it, to the actual process and then finishing it, does it feel like this time that you just had a bit more kind of room to breathe as you were writing it?
Yes, I think so. And because the other one I wrote in like 5 months, and it was, but I had nothing else on. I sat in my room and drank wine and smoked fags and wrote it sort of full time. But this I had to kind of, you know, I was back working and also, mum dying when I was writing it. So that chapter was an addition that I put that chapter in.
Mm-hmm.
So life kind of dictated how long it would take me to write the book, but I think it's a better book because I took longer as well. And I think, you know, and I also wrote a lot more than was included. Like this book is 80,000 words and you know this very well, Penny. I had to cut a lot out of it, and I had to cut stories and women who I interviewed as well, which was heartbreaking. But
I know we had a conversation at one point, and how many words was it at one point?
100,000 words, and I had to cut it back down to 80,000, which the editor, couple of editors helped me with, of course, but I had to sign it.
Oh, it's so painful.
Oh, it's horrific. And going to people and, you know, close friends who I'd interview going, I'm really sorry. But I think I might turn some of those stories into Substacks and use them in other ways, because they're just so brilliant anyway. But I learned a lot more, and I think I'm almost looking forward to writing the next book because I've learned from both ways, and I don't think either one was right or wrong, but having a bit longer was definitely good. But now it's 2 weeks until it actually goes out into the world. I'm like, I'm feeling all those wobbles and feelings, but I'm really proud of it, and I'm really pleased in the end. I got there, as we all do. We get there in the end.
Well, you should be proud. Honestly, it's magnificent, and it's beautiful and hopeful, and I'm sure there will be lots of people who also keep it on their bedside tables. Congratulations.
Well, thank you.
For finishing.
Thank you, Penny. That means a lot.
Oh, it's been so glorious to have a chat about it. Thank you.
Oh, I feel really flattered. I feel really honored that you, you know, A, you're part of it, B, you've read it, and C, you know, it's so nice to hear that just before it comes out, because I think this is our most vulnerable time as authors.
So difficult.
Horrific.
It's horrific. Just FYI, everyone.
It's really, I know. And I sometimes want to give myself a bit of a slap going, listen, you've got a book out and you just enjoy every minute, but there's this
all
part
of your
those brain.
Feelings can sit there at the same time. It's totally fine to be very happy and grateful and also absolutely shitting it at the same time. And also the, you know, like we've just had an hour long conversation talking about, you know, death, divorce, sex. It's, you know, got to go have a cup of tea and a sit down after this.
Yeah,
I know. It's energy.
It does. And it's all good stuff. But yeah, you do need a little bit of peace and quiet at the end. You know, you really do just kind of go, it's all right. Have a few deep breaths. You'll be right.
Thank you so much.